What did the actress say to the bishop? Où sont les neiges d'antan? That's your actual French.
How true that is, even today.
Quote, unquote. The quotations quiz devised and introduced by Nigel Rees.
Hello again. Our examination of pets quotations unleashed these further sightings, particularly on the differences between dogs and cats. From Bruce Ellis in Sydney, Australia, comes a popular bumper sticker down under, he says.
Dogs have owners, cats have committees.
According to Mark Revel, the internet is awash with this comparison.
Dogs have masters, cats have staff.
To a certain Jim Feibig is attributed...
You own a dog, you feed a cat.
And Marion Bock in New York fields this telling remark.
If you love a cat, set it free. If it comes back to you, it's hungry.
And thank you, Peter Jefferson, for reading those and what's to come. On the panel, we welcome back the journalist, Rosie Millard, actress, comedian, Yorkshirewoman, Jane Tunnicliffe, writer, director, stand-up, you name it, Stuart Lee, and the poor man's Kit Hesketh Harvey. That's Kit Hesketh Harvey. And first of all, we push the boat out with some first quotations. Rosie Millard, I wonder, do you recognise this quotation?
First, catch your hare.
Is this a cookbook?
Yes.
Is it Mrs. Beaton?
Well, it's sometimes thought to be in Mrs. Beaton's Household Management. Yes.
A Gentleman's Guide to Hunting, Shooting and Fishing.
Well, not really. It is a cookery book. There is a book
not
called...
Not Peter Rabbit, is it?
No. It's a real one. There's a book called The Art of Cookery Made Plain and Easy, which was written by Mrs. Hannah Glass in the 18th century. But it's a sort of proverbial thing, really, meaning you can't begin to do something until you've got the wherewithal.
Well, I once had a hilarious book, a cookery book for bachelors, and it was a sort of similar idea. There was a brilliant recipe for roast chicken. It said, you know, buy your chicken from the butcher, put it in the oven, take it out, put it on a plate, eat it. Duh.
That's the idea. Now then, another first one for Stuart Lee. Who is...
First among equals.
Well, I'm really ashamed to say that I don't know that. And, of course, that's an everyday common figure of speech. And
Title of a Geoffrey Archer novel, for example.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I knew that it wasn't that. that Geoffrey Archer must have got it from somewhere.
Yes, he did get it from somewhere. Curiously enough, he didn't...
Geoffrey Archer novels, they're the kind of novels that open with a quote from a Hardy novel or a D.H. Lawrence novel or a T.S. Eliot poem, but there are no Hardy novels or T.S. Eliot poems opening with a quote from Geoffrey Archer.
How true that is. Even today.
I don't know. I expect if I had a classical education, I'd know.
Well, you could do. Any offers? Primus
well,
inter pares.
Well, I have a classical education, and I know it's primus inter pares. But,
yes.
What?
Who is it referring
it
to?
I have no idea.
Is it a school motto?
It probably is a school
was
motto.
Was it Caesar or somebody?
Well, it's usually used about the role of the Prime Minister in the cabinet.
Is it?
The Prime Minister is the first among equals. And in 1988, Julian Crisley MP was quoted as having referred to... Margaret Thatcher as prima donna inter pares, but there you go. Now, Jane, where would you encounter this first?
Women and children first.
On the Titanic?
Yes.
The lifeboats.
Well, yes, it is.
Lifeboat etiquette.
It's said to go back to an incident in the 1852 when a boat called HMS Birkenhead went down and they only had three lifeboats for all the people on board.
But it brings a lump to your throat, doesn't it? I mean, it really is. So it's just... I don't know, I get all weepy about that sort of thing, I'm afraid.
Yeah. It also gives men a break.
Yes, thank you, Stuart. Somerset Maugham said he always chose to sail on French ships because there's none of that nonsense about women and children first. Kit Hesketh Harvey, how about the origins of...
Safety first.
Safety first. Is that, what was it, the Tufty Club?
Tufty.
Was it the Tufty Club?
Well, no, it's before the Tufty Club, I think one can say. It began in the United States in connection with railroad safety. You know, this is what railroads must have, safety first. And then it became a political slogan in this country for the conservatives, They fought an election on the slogan "Safety first."
I don't remember that one.
Well, it was much before your time. It was 1922.
Oh, I see. That's brilliant. Yes. Right.
In 1934, the National Safety First Association was founded in Britain, and it became associated with road and industrial safety. In round two, I ask you to explain what's going on in these quotations. Rosie, to what activity do you think this originally referred?
Too much is not enough.
Eating?
Could be.
Tickling?
Tickling. We're learning a lot about you, Rosie. Any other offers of what it might have been about originally?
Money?
Yes, yes. Yeah. What's one of your favourite activities, Rosie?
Shopping.
Shopping, yeah. I first heard it as a motto on some shoes belonging to Renata, the first wife of Elton John, as
indeed,
we might refer to her. It was from Beverly Feldman of Hollywood, and it was inscribed on the sole of the shoe, "Too much is not enough." Quote-unquote sleuths have found that it originally referred to love. In Beaumarchais' The Barber of Seville, with love, you see, too much is never enough. There you go. Now, Stuart, what's going on here?
Theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die.
Is it some piece of First World War poetry?
Earlier than the First World War, but certainly
it's
to do with
Charge of the Light Brigade.
It is, yeah, indeed. And do you know, yeah, who wrote it?
Yeah, Tennyson.
Tennyson,
yeah,
yes, yeah, Tennyson's, yeah. Charge of the Light Brigade, theirs but to do and die. Now, Jane, what's this got to do with The Price of Fish?
This is a postmodern novel before there was any modernism to be post about.
This is quite a recent remark. It counts as in a film.
I don't know, I'm sorry.
Do you know, Kit?
Well, I'm just getting Steve Coogan-y images.
Yes,
is it
you
Tristram
are.
Shandy?
It is the film of Tristram Shandy, yes. A cock and bull story, and he is appearing as himself in it, and he makes this rather nice remark. A post-modern novel before there was any modernism to be post about. And Kit, not so much what's it all about, but what connects these disparate sayings?
A prayer for the wild at heart, kept in cages. Strength of will. What nourishes me also destroys me. Know your rights.
Blimey. What nourishes me also destroys me.
You would
me.
Find all these quotations in the same place. And you would, in fact, find them tattooed on somebody's anatomy.
Is it David Beckham's body?
You're very single-minded, aren't you, Rosie?
Not David Beckham's body.
Oh, who do we know who's got tattoos everywhere?
Popeye.
It's not you, is it, Nigel?
Me?
He's run out of storage space for his quotations.
Yeah. Good. It's Angelina Jolie, whose body is covered with these things.
Really?
I don't know whether when she changes her mind or when she loses interest in a quotation, she has them removed.
Well, yes, because it was Johnny Depp, wasn't it, who had Winona Ryder, Winona Forever, tattooed on his body, and then...
It wasn't.
Actually, Johnny Depp had Winona Forever removed, and well, not removed, but shortened to Wino Forever, as it says on his arm.
Now, thank you. If you have helped us in our ceaseless task of refining and honing quotations to their essence, when Sir John Mortimer was on the programme, he slipped in one of his own favourite quotations concerning another Sir John, the actor John Gielgud.
A critic once said that below the waist, Mr. Gielgud means absolutely nothing.
But who was the critic? I thought at first that it might be a misremembering of what Kenneth Tynan wrote about Gielgud's The Ages of Man on Broadway in 1959.
I've always felt that Sir John Gielgud is the finest actor on earth, from the neck up.
The answer lies, however, in what the critic Ivor Brown wrote about Gielgud's first Romeo in May 1924.
Mr. Gielgud has the most meaningless legs imaginable.
Which brings us snappily to our first quotation theme of the week, which is parts of the body. What have you dug out for us on that score, Rosie Millard? Which part of the body have you gone for?
Well, I would like to start off in a cerebral style with a quotation from the poet Robert Frost about the brain. The brain, he says, is a wonderful organ. It starts working the moment you get up in the morning and doesn't stop until you get to the office. And then eyes. Jerry Dennis. Met a guy this morning with a glass eye. He didn't tell me, it just came out in conversation.
Stuart Lee, parts of the body.
my hair's receding at a great rate, so I became fascinated by hair quotes. And this is my favourite one from Clive Anderson. This is a good excuse. He says, "I'm not bald, I'm just taller than my hair." Then I found this one on a rather more general theme from Miss Piggy, who is not a real person, is a puppet. And she said, "Only time can heal your broken heart, just as only time can heal his broken arms and legs." Robin Williams, this sounded like it might be from personal experience, he said, "God gave us a penis and a brain, but not enough blood to use both at once."
Thank you very much, Stuart. Jane Tunnicliffe.
I like people who are really self-deprecating about their appearances, and I'd like to start with one from Joan Rivers, which she said, "I have no boobs whatsoever. On my wedding night, my husband said, 'Let me help you with those buttons.'" And my favourite one is from Tallulah Bankhead. I don't know who she said it to, but she said, "Keep looking at my eyes, darling. My arse is like an accordion."
Well, we're certainly covering the body. Kit Esketh-Rabi.
We've just come back from touring Australia with Joan Rivers. That old woman Rivers who just keeps rolling along, as we call her. Our task is to warm her up. We're her sort of fluffers. But we do so in a song which includes the couplet, "The woman must be in her upper 80s. The only rivers older are the Nile and the Euphrates." But I love her remark about the southward descent of her body parts. "I've started to use my left breast as a bath plug." But to quote my own beloved widow, the guy I work with, he said the other day, "I still live in hope of getting my leg over. It's just that with my sciatica, I might not get it back again."
Right, well, I think we can put our bodies away for the time being. And round three of the quiz brings us once more to the examination of titles and where people swipe them from. Rosie Millard, there is a detective novel by Emma Lathan with the title...
"Ashes to Ashes."
Where does that quotation come from?
I would say it's probably from the authorised version, Burial Service.
It's from the... Burial Service, but not from the authorised. It's from the Book of Common Prayer.
Well, Book of Common Prayer, sorry, excuse me. Book of Common Prayer.
Yeah, we therefore commit his body to the ground, earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Yes, Stuart Lee, as the writer of an opera, I expect you'll know this. Why did Vaughan Williams call one of his operas...
Sir John in Love?
You know, when I came to direct Joe Spring the Opera, I'd never seen an opera. And I was brought into it for an outsider eye. And now I've left the genre of opera to go back to being an outsider. Sir John in Love. I haven't the faintest idea.
Rosie's put a finger up.
Isn't it Sir John Falstaff?
Yes.
Of Henry IV, parts one and
exactly.
two
fame. So who actually...
Was it Queen Elizabeth, because she'd seen part one or something, and she said, "I long to see Sir John in Love," or something like that?
She'd seen the first two parts of Shakespeare's Henry IV, and she, according to the story, commanded Shakespeare to continue it for one play more and to show him in love.
And was that The Merry Wives of Windsor, then?
Yes, precisely so, which Vaughan Williams turned into an opera. Yeah. Jane Tunnicliffe. There was an album by George Harrison with this title. There was even a film with this title in 1940. Why?
Somewhere in England.
Oh, I really don't know, actually. That's rather annoying.
Why would you use that phrase, somewhere in England? Rosie?
Well, it sounds like a First World War poem, but that's obviously somewhere in France.
Did you say a First World War poem?
Poem, yeah.
Yeah, well, it certainly started First World War and certainly started in France, I think. The idea was for, in military security, you weren't allowed to say precisely where something had happened, and so this formula emerged of somewhere in France, and then it came to be broadened to anywhere you cannot name. Yeah, somewhere in England. And Kit Hesketh-Harvey, where did Joyce Grenfell find the title for one of her books?
In Pleasant Places.
I've no idea where In Pleasant Places are. Is it John Dryden or somewhere, or...
Anybody else care to suggest where it might be from? In Pleasant Places?
Beatrix Potter.
Not Beatrix Potter. The actual quote is, "The lines are fallen unto me in pleasant places. Yea, I have a goodly heritage." So it's not Beatrix Potter, it's the Bible. Psalm 16:6, and the Oxford Dictionary in defining lines suggests that the reference needs to be the marking out of land for a dwelling place. Now, round four concentrates on many quotations. That's quotations emphasising the word many. Rosie, how about...
For many are called, but few are chosen.
Is this from Milton?
Not from Milton. Stuart is scratching his head. Again, it's from the Bible, this time the New Testament. Matthew 22:14, describing what heaven is like. For many are called, but few are chosen. Yeah. And it's so, after he's told the parable of the marriage feast, and it's just after the bit about darkness and weeping and gnashing of teeth and all the rest of it.
It's on the gravestone of a Labour politician in Stoke Newington Cemetery. And I went on a tour of Stoke Newington Cemetery, and the guide said, does anyone know where that quote's from? And I went, yeah, it's from a song by the Welsh progressive rock band Man. And he went, it's not the original source.
Yeah. From Matthew 22:14, and I once heard about the Irish father of a family of nine who used to say, many are called, but few get up. Now, Stuart, whence this...
Many different herrings.
This is from a musical. I'll...
Oh, one of those musicals about fish.
Now, this is a Swedish person, and she's describing her day. She says, from 8 to 9, Ulla like to have a big Swedish breakfast. Many different herrings. And at 11, Ulla like to have sex. Now, Kit, where is this from?
It's the producers.
Yes.
Yeah, of course.
It's not in the original producer's film, but in the musical.
It's in the musical version, isn't it?
Yeah, lovely. Now, Jane, what on earth is this all about?
Many a mickle makes a muckle.
Have you ever heard that?
I have. It's a Scottish saying, isn't it?
Yeah, often said.
Oh, possibly Yorkshire. I don't know.
What do you think it means, or is thought to mean? Rosie?
I've no idea.
Is it referring to coinage?
Well, it could do. In fact, it doesn't mean anything at all, but it's supposed to mean that, you know, a lot of small quantities make a big quantity. Many a little makes a much. But in fact, it's meaningless cod Scots. And the Scots form is many a mickle maks a muckle. So that's probably where you heard it like that, yeah. But it makes no sense in either English or Scottish, but one gets the drift.
Yeah, thanks for that, Nigel. Yeah.
Look after the pennies and the pounds will look after themselves. Yep. It would be much easier, much clearer.
Yep. And Kit, how about this catchphrase?
Many times. Many, many times. Many, many, many times.
I don't, it's blissful when Peter says it. I've no idea. It sounds actorly.
It is actorly, in a way, yes. It's radio archaeology.
Is it from Round the Horn?
It is from Round the Horn, Jane.
Can't remember which character. Probably Kenneth Williams.
Well, it wasn't actually. It was Betty Marsden as Lady Beatrice Counterblast, nay Clissold.
Yes.
And it was who was a sort of aged actress, and they used to tell her story. Originally, it was in answer to a query as to how many times she'd been married. And this catchphrase was in position from the very first edition of the show in 1965.
According to your biographer, Hesketh Podmore, you've been married many times.
Yes, many times. Many, many times. Many, many.
Now, tell me about your first husband.
I remember once Barry Took telling me, Barry Took, one of the co-writers of Round the Horn, that around the time when the show was on and he took off this catchphrase, he went to see The Sound of Music, and the Mother Superior, or whatever she's called, at some stage said, oh, yes, many, many times, and the audience just fell about. And so, to the theme of the moment, fame and the famous... Rosie Millar, what quotations have you got on this theme?
To understand modern celebrity, we need to go to PJ O'Rourke, who said, you can't shame or humiliate modern celebrities. What used to be called shame and humiliation is now called publicity. And forget traditional character assassination. If you say that a modern celebrity is an adulterer, a pervert, and a drug addict, all it means is that you've read his autobiography. Steve Martin, who... knows quite a lot about celebrity, being one, said a celebrity is any well-known TV or movie star who looks like he spends more than 2 hours working on his hair. Dame Edna, alias, obviously, Barry Humphreys, talking about someone, saying he's very, 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 very famous. He's very, very, very well-known. I'd say he's world-famous in Melbourne. And this is Daniel Boorstin. Some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some hire public relations officers.
Yeah.
And really, to understand the sine qua non of modern celebrity, I would like to try this gag on you, Nigel. Knock,
please.
Knock.
Who's there?
Caprice.
Caprice who?
That's showbiz.
I get your drift now. Stuart Lee, fame, celebrity, whatever.
Well, Fred Allen, American comic, he said, a celebrity is a person who works hard all his life to become well-known and then wears dark glasses to avoid being recognised. Now, here's one from Napoleon. This is just wise. He said, glory is fleeting, but obscurity is forever. And it's great, isn't it? And there's a brilliant statue in Trafalgar Square, if you ever get a chance to walk through. I can't remember who it's of. It's of some general from the 1700s. And at the bottom it says, he will never be forgotten. And it's someone you have just never heard of since. And it's a really good reminder of that notion. Henry Kissinger said, the nice thing about being a celebrity is that when you bore people, they think it's their fault. Yeah, here's a couple from celebrities who should know about fame. This was Johnny Mathis talking about Diana Ross. He said, her desire for fame is like her hair. It keeps getting bigger. And then Barbara Streisand said this, which I don't think is a fantastic quote, but it does conjure up an interesting image. Barbara Streisand said, success to me is having 10 honeydew melons and eating only the top half of each slice. Which suggests that she did that at some stage. And I just imagine Barbara Streisand surrounded by half-eaten melons, and it makes that quote worthwhile. And this was a good one. We couldn't find the attribution for it. It's anonymous, but it's very good. The final test of fame is to have a crazy person imagine that he is you. And I'd like to dedicate that to the 35-year-old woman currently pretending to be me on MySpace.com, where my interests are listed by not me as film noir and all 80s music. So I'm going to check those out and see what it'd be like if I actually was me and liked those things.
Yeah. How is fame treating you?
I'm in that sort of layer of recognition whereby people talk to me in the street but can't quite place me and so assume that I'm the next minor celebrity along who looks like me, which means I've had a lot of conversations with people who think that I'm Terry Christian from The Word having put on weight, or the lead singer of UB40, which has been some fascinating situations. I was actually really aggressively harassed by a man on Charing Cross Road a few weeks ago who insisted that I was the original Tucker Jenkins from Grange Hill and was really furious with me for denying it.
Yes, and now Jane Tunnicliffe, if you're in Coronation Street at the moment, do people recognise you all the time?
They do, yeah, when you're buying, you know, things like toilet rolls in supermarkets and just things that you wouldn't want to be seen buying, really.
Not the sort of thing that stars buy.
Not stars, but no, you want to be buying champagne, obviously, and things like that, but I never am, so yeah, it's rather embarrassing.
So what quotations have you got on fame and celebrity?
I'd like to start with one from Ralph Rosenblum, who was majorly Woody Allen's film editor in the 70s. And he recounted that he was having lunch with Woody Allen in a New York cafeteria when a middle-aged woman came up and said to him, are you Woody Allen? And Woody mumbled, yes. She went back to her table, then a moment later came back and said, are you sure you're Woody Allen? Then Ethel Barrymore, who's Michael's sister, I think. I'm not sure about that. But Ethel Barrymore said, half the people in Hollywood are dying to be discovered and the other half are afraid they will be. From Diana Dawes, actually, who was always good for a pithy quote. She said, at the height of his Bond fame, Sean Connery could have had any woman in the world, and as far as I could see, he often did. And finally, one from star of Thelma and Louise, actress Gina Davis, who said, I've had lots of fan mail, but I do remember one abusive letter. It wasn't signed, but it had a P.S. If undelivered, please forward to Demi Moore.
Kit Hesketh Harvey, fame.
I work a bit in opera these days, and I love the story of Sir David Webster, who was the one-time artistic director at Covent Garden, to whom the late Queen Mother remarked as they descended the grand staircase of the Opera House to a smattering of appreciative applause, "I don't know why they're clapping, dear. We're just a pair of old queens descending a staircase." But the greatest celebutante, I suppose, was Truman Capote. He kind of invented the art form, of whom Gore Vidal said on hearing of his death, "Good career move." Mind you, it was Gore Vidal who also said, "It is not enough to succeed, others must fail." But one of the great victims of celebrity, famously, was the blessed Stephen Fry, of course, to whom Hugh Laurie's message, when he did a bunk abroad, purportedly ran, "Our concern, Stephen, is not that you've walked out of a West End production. It is not that every journalist in Britain is on a manhunt for you. It is not that your previous psychological history is causing your friends the gravest concern. It is that you've been seen in Belgium and wearing a beret. Clearly you are gravely ill. Please come home at once." And it worked.
And a final one from anybody? Yeah, Stuart?
There's the story of Peter Cook on the door of the establishment club and refusing entry to a politician who thought he was well known enough to be let in. And the man said to Peter Cook, "Don't you know who I am?" And so Peter Cook left and went to the stage and went, "There's a man at the door who doesn't know who he is, if anyone can help him out."
And finally, it must be a week or two since we had a quotation from the great H.L. Mencken, but this is very much apropos. He defined a celebrity as...
"One who is known to many persons he's glad he doesn't know."
And here, not about celebrities, is a really excellent remark from the American humorist Irvin S. Cobb. On a visit to London towards the end of the First World War, a woman asked him who would win the war. Replied he...
"My dear friend, may I ask you who won the San Francisco earthquake?"
And on that somber note from quote unquote, goodbye now.
Taking part in quote unquote were Kit Hesketh Harvey, Stuart Lee, Rosie Millard, and Jane Tunnicliffe. The quotations were read by me, Peter Jefferson. Nigel Rees devised and introduced the programme, and the producer was Claire Bartlett.